are listening to the Global Product Management Talk, a regular broadcast for passionate product professionals and business people that don't get a chance to leave their desk and participate in product talks in person, so we bring product talks to you wherever you are. Every episode, we discuss different aspects of what it takes to produce successful products. Everyone is invited, including agile practitioners, user experience designers, content and community managers, business owners, CEOs, entrepreneurs, social media strategists, innovation managers, business analysts, project managers, product managers, program managers, product marketing managers, brand managers, software developers, and you, as well as everyone involved with the entire product lifecycle process from inception to sunsetting. Follow us on Blog Talk Radio. Go to www.blogtalkradio.com/PRODMGMTTALK. That's our website, www.PRODMGMTTALK.com. Follow us on Twitter at PRODMGMTTALK and use the hashtag to tweet answers to the questions and follow the tweets, # PRODMGMTTALK.
Hello, this is Cindy F. Solomon coming to you today with the Global Product Management Talk from the Oakland Hills in California today, broadcasting live. We have three people on the phone. This is very exciting. We're coming up on a year and a half of broadcasting since we started from a Twitter chat. So if you've been listening, you know that every week or often we iterate, we try new products and tools, and we are in the top 10 of business podcasts on the Blog Talk Radio Network. You can find us at blogtalkradio.com/PRODMGMTTALK. If you are tweeting with us today, please use the hashtag PRODMGMTTALK. Today, our speaker is Glenn Lipka. Glenn, can you hear me?
I can hear you, Cindy. Can you hear me?
Yay! I can hear you. Yes. So, and our co-host today is Tarek Lewis. Are you there, Tarek?
Cindy, I am here. Can you hear me?
This is superb. So usually we have some time ahead of time to do some banter. We'll just do banter live on the air. And as our listeners know, you can catch us being candid during the live show. And then you can listen later on to the edited podcast. So it's very exciting today because for the first time, I'm actually sitting in a sound booth. There's an engineer outside of the room. I know he's waving to me. Let's get official here. But by the way, so this is a conversation that we have. The intention is to flip the webinar on its head. So we're pretty informal. We welcome you to call in and talk to us. We do have a prepared discussion. So the Global Product Management Talk is for passionate product professionals who are so busy they don't have time to leave their desk to engage in product talks on a regular basis. I bring together thought leaders and experts and practitioners to have these talks for you to listen to. And you can listen to it on iTunes, on any mobile app that you can get podcasts. And we even have our own mobile app on the Android at Google Play. You can get it. Everything is by PRODMGMTTALK. I want to thank our sponsor, the AIPMM, the Association of Product Marketing and Management, which brings education, training, networking, and forms of professional growth for people who are interested in product management, in product marketing, brand management, and forwarding their career with getting certified. They have certification trainings and credentials in many areas, including the Agile Certified Manager, Certified Product Manager, Certified Product Marketing Manager, the Certified Brand Manager, and a new one, the Certified Innovation Leader. I highly recommend these trainings, especially for people who are new to the field or find themselves being thrown in to manage products, whether they're software, services, or hardware. Because you're good at other things or you're good at managing, these courses give you a foundation in being excellent. Also, today, our new sponsor is Atlassian. You can go to Atlassian.com, A-T-L-A-S-S-I-A-N. Atlassian, helping transform teams who are building software. Atlassian helps innovators everywhere plan, build, and launch great software. So check them out at Atlassian.com. Thanks to our friend of the broadcast, Nick Muldoon. And our intro theme music was provided by podcastthemes.com. Stand by, I'm almost done with the commercial aspect here.
I'm loving it.
Today, we are talking about From Idea to Reality with Glenn Lipka, who is the Vice President of User Experience at Marketo. User experience, specifically design, is just a decision, and there is decision in every design process. Who makes the decisions is not necessarily a specific designer, but rather an accumulation of all the decisions that got made by everyone in the company. And that might be engineering people, an end user, a manager, or a researcher, but at the end of the day, according to Glenn, the designer is the one who writes the product document requirements, the PRD, and the UX designer and the product manager roles might overlap. At Marketo, he says that UX sits in the middle of engineering in order to iterate with a lot of people. But design doesn't stop when the product is handed off to engineering. Rather, it continues until the product ships. And the product manager must determine what is the real problem we are trying to solve. So I first met Glenn last year when he spoke at the Silicon Valley Product Managers Association. And he is Vice President of User Experience at Marketo, where he was the first non-founder employee that ran product management in UX for several years of the company's development. Prior to Marketo, he was a senior UI designer at Intuit, Director of User Experience at AdKimi, and started his career running a 30-person web development company in New York City during the internet bubble. He has been a pioneer in websites and web applications for over 15 years, pushing the envelope in interactivity on public-facing websites. He speaks frequently in all aspects of building great products on the web, including at the NYU Stern School of Business and Stanford University. Check out his blog at commadot.com. That's commadot.com. And I want to introduce you to our co-host, which I'm delighted to welcome. Tarek Lewis founded Stanzer, and I met him when I first started the Global Product Management Talk as a Twitter chat. Stanzer is a social media chat platform, and Tarek also led initial sales, marketing, and channel development for Hivefire and Terametric, and he's a member of the San Francisco Startup Product Talks community. So welcome, Tarek and Glenn. If you are tweeting, which as soon as I stop talking, I will go out and welcome people who are out on Twitter, please use the hashtag PRODMGMTTALK. Our first question always is, please introduce yourself, where you're tweeting from, and your involvement with product management. And I'm going to pass it over to Glenn to take it away and fill in what I may have left off. And feel free to jump in there, Tarek, before we go into Q1.
Hi, how are you? Pleasure to be here.
Great. Is there anything I left out in terms of just providing a little bit of an orientation?
No, it's good. I was just soaking it all in.
Awesome. And Tarek, anything you want to add to the intro?
Not at all. I am still just amazed at Ben's just depth of expertise and experience in user experience and design. I am just like in awe. So I'm in the presence of greatness right now, and I'm looking forward to an awesome convo.
Great. So
Ben, was that too much? Is that okay, Ben? I mean, was that better?
No, I appreciate it. Thank you.
All right.
Okay. So what's very cool about this is, look, people who are passionate about building products are extremely bright and experienced people, so I just have a blast every week talking with them. First question is, how do you define user experience? The acronym is UX. A very broad question, but we'll warm up with this, Glenn.
Sure. I actually think a lot of companies get this wrong, but from the customer's perspective, from the user's perspective, it's everything. So if you have a good example that I use all the time is credit cards, where you know, I pull out my wallet and I'm going to hand the guy a credit card, and I always give them a Discover card. And the reason is I used to give them an American Express card, and one time they called me, and the person was rude to me on the phone. And that just that one interaction soured me on using American Express, and I hardly ever use it anymore. And then the Discover, by contrast, they were nice to me on the phone. Now, they're a multi-billion dollar brand, each of them, and I, as one individual, let one person from each of their support organizations influence my buying decisions. And whenever you interact with any company, whether you're talking to their legal team or their billing, you know, like you're trying to get a bill reconciled, or you're dealing with the application or technology itself, or a salesperson interacted with you, as a user, you think of that all of that as one big representation of the company. And any one of them can give you a chance to say, I love working with these guys, or conversely, I hate working with these guys. And so it's really incumbent on the entire organization to realize they're part of that user experience team, and that not just doing it the way that you've always done it, but looking for ways to make it special for the customer, make it a friendly experience so that they have that Discover-like experience instead of the American Express experience I had had. And it all comes down to what the user sees through their eyes, and because their experience is all-encompassing and holistic. So I define UX that way. Although in a lot of organizations, they really mess up the definition, and it's really just become an evolution of user interface design. And that I actually, when I'm interviewing a lot of people for positions here at Marketo, I'll find that they really never done UX, and that all they've done was user interface, or all they've done is design websites, for example, and that user experience takes into account a much broader array of psychological cause and effect relationships. When someone feels the system is slow, how does that affect their workflow? If they're the kind of people who want to have wizards, or are they the kind of people who want to have direct manipulation, and why, and where does that come from? It's more about that psychology. But the UX team at Marketo, we've really try to influence every different department to make sure that our voice is consistent and giving that positive experience. But I know that, you know, not everyone is making that same definition.
Wait, if I could jump in here, Glenn, that's pretty interesting. It seems that, I mean, I'm listening here, and you know, I'm getting the idea that, I mean, in terms of any touch point between the customer and the product or service experience, you would say then is user experience. I'd be surprised that some people couldn't say, well, I've worked in customer service, or, you know, I've worked with, you know, other parts of this, you know, I've worked in sales or something like that to be part of that customer experience. I mean, I feel as though that there is a scope, or is it that broad, really?
Yeah, you know, there used to be an acronym that I don't hear that much anymore, but it's still around, user-centered design, UCD.
Yeah.
And what it was about was saying, rather than think about the world from our eyes, let's think about the world from the user's eyes. And if you think about what is UX from their eyes, they're not going to differentiate between, like, what do you think about company is going to be informed by all your touch points, not just, you're not going to segment in your mind, well, that's the support team or that's the interface. I mean, Dell, as an example, had that bad rap a few years ago about their India support staff was not helping solve problems well enough. And from the customer standpoint, they don't care. They're just saying, I don't like Dell as a brand,
right?
So user experience has that holistic view from the user standpoint. Although if you think of it from inside the company standpoint, it's funny how everyone could like make up their own, you know, areas of excellence. Like, well, we're support, and that's a support experience, or we're account management, so that's a customer experience. And even though user might be the wrong noun, UX has taken on a pretty good catch-all in saying UX is that holistic view, although realistically in most organizations it's centered on product design, not on the holistic view.
The holistic view. Got it. Interesting. Thank you. That was pretty impressive. I'm looking at some of these questions here, and you know, the second one we have is who is responsible for design decisions? And I guess, you know, maybe that's a nice question to ask given your definition. When you see the organization today and you see you know, professionals focused on product, what is really, I mean, what is the true map of the decision-making process for design? Who is responsible for the design decision-making? Who should be?
Right. And you're saying at Marketo specifically? Or are you saying in the theoretical best practice?
Well, why don't we start with Marketo and then talk about theoretical best practice? I would love to know how Marketo looks at it.
Well, as Cindy said before, and this is something I tell people all the time, design is decisions. That it's somewhat of a trick question in the sense of whoever makes a decision, that's what the user, from their point of view, is the reality of the world. So, in other words, their cars have the steering wheel on the left in the United States. It's on the right in England. Now, somebody somewhere at some point made that decision, but that's the design of the car. And that every single thing that you interact with, the way that the phone works, the QWERTY keyboard and how it was designed to slow down your typing, it was all a decision that got made, and that becomes the reality. So what I'm saying is that if you think of the word design, what is the design? And you think of the word reality, what is the reality? They're synonymous. That what is there is the final design. It is the reality. And it is that compilation of decisions that got made, whoever made them. Now, the question really comes down, who should be making those decisions?
Yep, good.
I was actually reading this book, Insanely Simple, and it was about how Steve Jobs and Apple and their advertising group had made decisions and this kind of cult of simplicity and how they used, how they structured their meetings, how they structured their committees to keep simplifying as a discipline. You know, that cult of simplicity is actually very difficult because complexity is much easier. And if you think about how decisions get made in most organizations, it's by committee or by accident. And that those decisions are very often, they lead to blasé products that don't do anything special and it just sort of passes the time. And sometimes you get lucky and there's something good in there, but most of the time products are pretty unexceptional. And that when you get a small team of smart people and that they have a mission, and there was actually a quote in the book saying the best way to make something great is to have a small group of smart people with not quite enough time to do a task. And that, you know, they need a little bit of pressure, you know, a small group of smart people. And those decisions are sometimes collaborative. Sometimes somebody has a vision and they're moving forward. If you look at how key web technologies like HTTP or HTML and how they were originally developed, it was the vision of one or two people collaborating in a short period of time, and they've set the foundation for trillions of dollars of value in the world. And if you had said, do the exact same thing but do it as a committee of 10 people, it wouldn't have gotten done properly. This is, committees are where ideas go to die. And so at Marketo, we started off with the founder. There were three founders and me, and then that grew to like 5 or 10 people. And then that first year, I don't think we were over 15 people. And now we're at 380 people. And I've been watching like a amateur anthropologist of how the decision-making has been evolving and changing and how the addition of more people has made it so that on the one hand, we could do a lot more. We could swing the bat harder, you know, for what we're aiming to do. At the same time, the communication overhead has become more and more significant. And decision-making becomes harder, especially as new people don't have the context of previous interactions, what you might call rapport. When you have a rapport with somebody, you can speak in shorthand and get to a decision that makes sense. When you're new working with someone, you have to work through that so that you can get to a consensus.
Right.
The thing about consensus is that if you're in an organization and that everyone is arguing, it's very hard to move forward. You need agreement. Whether that agreement is you win some, you lose some, like in the case of Marketo, we have this concept of chips. And so I say, of all the different things that I want to have happen, I want to use my chips on this one aspect because it's really important to me. And I make sure that I win that argument. But in other arguments, I ran out of chips. So now somebody else can use their chips and they get to win that argument. And that sometimes that does result in a camel, you know, where there's different people winning different parts of it. But as long as like at Marketo, as long as the group of people who are doing that is maintained relatively small, like under four people, then that sort of horse trading can end up with something pretty good. I've always felt that the best products and services do have a leader within the organization, an architect, somebody who is making those final decisions. And at Marketo, the CEO is a very strong product guy and really helps with that. And I play a pretty strong role in terms of that product architecture and how it's going to move forward. But as we grow, we're constantly evolving, thinking about how the process should work. And more importantly, it's not just the way the product is today, because it's a living organism. We release every month. So what the design decision sometimes is, well, which thing should we work on? And so who is making those decisions, and how are they making those decisions? Like, where's the prioritization coming from? Because in a SaaS world, the design you have today is not really what customers are buying. They're buying right. the long term of upgrades, because you have the product ongoing, you pay for it ongoing.
Right, right. So you would say that you've successfully, at least at Marketo, put in place a disciplined system of design in spite of growth that has survived the growth, is what you guys have done really well, is what you're saying.
Yeah, I mean, one of the key things I find to make it work, and I'll hopefully keep this with me wherever I go, is to institutionalize design with a responsibility. There's a lot of organizations, like when I was at Intuit, the CEO said that the design group, including all the UX people, had no specific responsibilities and that they were there just to support the business owners. Whereas I thought that's a perfect way to alienate them, isolate them, and to ignore their feedback. It's better to take the design group and say, you have a very specific responsibility with people who are depending on you to deliver. In the case of Marketo, the design deliverable is the PRD. These are in the form of PowerPoint storyboards that spec out all the details of what is supposed to be built. And engineering counts on that to deconstruct it down into user stories within Jira, which our friends at Atlassian, who's a sponsor, will be happy.
Yeah.
And we put those into Jira, and they do the estimates, and that's how we communicate with engineering of what we want to build in a high fidelity way, yet still doing it very rapidly. And without that responsibility, then it would be very blurry between product management and UX of who's delivering what. We really focus on what does the deliverable look like and who's responsible for it. And that helps delineate which part of the process is you are an owner versus an influencer. Like in the MRDs, I'm an influencer, but I'm not the owner. In the PRDs, we're the owner, and engineering and market and product management are and product marketing are influencing what goes into that design.
So here's my question. Do you think that your current discipline could survive a faster release cycle than on a monthly basis, given that particular approach? Do you think that construct can survive, say, a biweekly or weekly release?
There's some technical things that we need to deal with internally to go to those faster releases, specifically like better continuous integration servers and better automated testing.
Right. Right.
However, if we were in a world where it was release every day, well, when you're designing something, there has to be a thought process around what is the user trying to do, what is the problem are they trying to solve, and what are all the different pieces of the puzzle. And that you can't necessarily deliver the brakes of a car and say, well, this is iterative development, here are the brakes, and I'll have the rest of it later. So it's possible that you're releasing pieces of this into an environment that is not visible to the user but is being slowly integrated, in which case that's fine. It's fine to iterate. We still need to design what that whole feature looks like, at least at a minimum viable standpoint. We don't have to design every feature we'll ever want ever, but we need to architect for growth, and we need to design for what's the first viable customer-facing version of this. And how that gets released is more of an engineering decision. But we need to make sure they know where we're going and what we're building, especially when it's the kind of a feature that has multiple moving parts.
Right. Excellent. No, that's great. Thank you. So, Cindy, I'm going to jump in another question here.
No, I just want to say it's having another person with an accent, so I appreciate your accent.
Okay. I hope that comes over the tweets. Everyone, this is an accent. I don't know if Glenn remember. We met once when I was at the Marketo event, I think, of last year's Dreamforce, and I was five drinks in, and I think Glenn maybe remembered me from my accent then and my sober accent now. But all right. So I think we're talking about questions now. We're talking about iteration and feature requirements. Maybe let's talk about prioritizing. I think you've sort of touched on that in talking about the framework that Marketo uses. Is there anything special, Glenn, that you guys use in the prioritization process, seeing everything from the biggest customers scream the loudest, so their feature set maybe gets prioritized, down to the biggest market with the biggest opportunity gets prioritized, down to the investors, anybody, all other stakeholders? I mean, how do you guys tackle the prioritization problem, and maybe some cool tricks and tips that you guys use that maybe the rest of us could steal while we're listening?
I was actually talking to our first official product manager after me, Cheryl Chavez, here, about that very topic today. I said there were two parts of it. One part of it is developing the backlog of things that we want to do. Before they're in any order, what is it that we want to do, and with a lot of reasons of why. And sometimes those whys come into narratives that you want to tell the market, and that different things bundle together to tell that narrative. Other times it's users who are saying, I really need to solve this problem, and that that research that product management is doing is isolating that. Sometimes it's about product marketing saying, hey, if you solve this kind of problem, there's this money to be made, and that this market is really ripe for disruption. There's a lot of different reasons why you'd want to put something in the backlog. And then the question of the order of it, I've always found to be a magical craft, in the sense of it's probably my favorite thing to do over the years, is to think about all these different pieces on a backlog and why we should do them in a particular order. Specifically, finding those little gems that are low down on the list, but the combination of those three gems equal way more than they would have been independently. And that seeing the story that could be told, or the foundation that could be built through smaller, more tactical releases, rather than think of very big bangs, or that a small thing is just a small thing and it never gets any love. And I love the craft of finding that right order. And it's almost like cooking, where the order that you go in and how hot you make certain ingredients, something might be slow roll over 6 months and another thing might be all hands on deck. And that art and craft, I think, is what makes the best product managers and product leaders. And so at Marketo, it has absolutely evolved over the years. In the very beginning, it was me. Then when Cheryl had joined us, it was her and me and Phil, the CEO, and the founders were collaborating with us as well. And then over time, as the product management team grew, we've been developing different ways of looking at it, some of which worked pretty well and others didn't work pretty well. And we've been evolving over the years of how we deal with that. As to even right now, there's five different product managers, and they each have an independent backlog and independent engineers that they can use to apply to their backlog. And I actually find that a great way to scale, because then you're not looking at five times backlog. You're looking at only one times backlog, and it's much easier to think about it. And then I could then say, you may want to horse trade with this other product manager around one of his resources, because that will get him these two things that are on his list.
Wow, that's awesome. So you guys have found a way, as you've evolved through growth, to even, again, segment that, segmented into the various product managers that you have, which is pretty awesome. I mean, is there a part where, when you look at companies that seem to struggle with this, is there a particular area you see where they fall down, where, they become bad cooks? And maybe put a little bit too much salt, or a little bit too much pepper, when they're thinking of trying to harness this.
Some of it, and it might go to one of the other questions that you had, has to do with the proportions between engineering, product management, and UX. That you need balance. I was at an organization where they had two people in design and 12 people in product management, and it was just impossible to make the conversation work. Right. I've been in other places of where the ratio between designer and engineer was 1 to 20, and that it really doesn't work when you have those kind of proportions. Here at Marketo, it's more like 1 to 8, 1 to 9.
Yeah.
and that you really need that kind of balance between people so that the voices can be heard in moderation. Additionally, one of the things that I find in a lot of organizations is that they think that their customers know what they're talking about. So when you ask somebody, what do you think we should build? I have never heard a customer give any sort of sensible answer. And if you ever go to a customer and say, I built this, what do you think? Again, it's almost never a sensible answer. And that certainly at Marketo, but this is something that I've just, you know, has been drilled into me 1,000 times. You have to have a vision. You have to know where you're going. You have to know why you're going there. And you have to believe that the market is going to love what you built if you put that energy and detail into it. With that said, you still have to pay attention to how are they actually using it, what is actually happening. You can't deny reality, but it's a difference between seeing how people actually use something versus predicting what they will use based on asking them. I never find that works in the latter, whereas we try to focus more on building something that makes sense, building something that we think people are going to love, and then interacting with them as they're using it and keeping our ears open for what we expect to happen and what actually happens.
To keep the vision again coming back. And I like how you focus on having balance. I feel that, if one can establish balance at the start of building your product organization, that becomes part of that discipline that extends through growth the way Marketo has done it over the years. If you start right, you can definitely grow far.
Yeah. At some point, it's an executive leadership thing in that headcounts are defined by executives, and that you need to get very early on the concept of we want to keep these two groups in a one-to-one ratio.
There is that issue of power and control at the executive level as well. Okay, so now let's talk now a little bit about the line between UX and product management. Even I myself, as a new product manager, is seeing this line blur quite a bit. What's your take on delineating the two, separating the two, how they should work together? Hook us up. Tell us what you think here.
Definitely, I believe in the structure where engineering, product management, and UX are peers. You know, they're three legs of a stool. Mm-hmm. And that each one, like during the process between problem definition and priority, product design and specification, and then engineering and QA and release, you know, which I included QA and ops in that engineering group, that each group is influencing the other two during the other off stages, yet each one also has ownership over one of those stages. And I think that what that leads to is that product management shouldn't be the ones who are doing product design, and that UX shouldn't be prioritizing which feature comes first, or defining like what problem we should solve. With that said, we influence them and they influence us on both scores. But what I really count on from product management is that they've thought through the different problems we want to solve and have thought through that art and craft of ordering it. Because what happens is, and I tell people this all the time, you point me towards a stupid problem and I'll give you a great answer. It's not going to build a great business, but I'll give you a great answer. If you point me towards a great problem, right, I'll give you a great answer. And that's something that you can build a real business on.
So therefore, given that, when we think of the direction of influence and maybe the sequence, product management must come first to UX, given the framework you described, and then UX gives feedback to product management based on what the management team has determined, you know, customers should get or the roadmap ahead to the market.
It sometimes even comes a little bit earlier where product marketing gets involved or the CEO or some other executives or even sales. So like if sales says we can close this deal if only you would build X, Y, or Z, which comes up a lot, right?
Yeah.
I definitely feel like it's important for an organization to resist that as much as possible, or if you have to do it, at least productize it in a way where it will be beneficial to everyone, not just to that one company. But very often that it starts even more uphill where a CEO says, what we really need is, you know, a dynamic suitcase, or we want to build Twitter for penguins or whatever it is. And the product management has to go figure out what that means.
Right.
And that it's almost putting a level, like when you think about user research, I usually resist that within the UX team, but I really encourage that within the product management team. you know, to really understand who the people are and personas and why they feel the way they feel and want what they want. But I definitely count on product management and then uphill from that product marketing, sales, and executives before it comes to UX. We think of ourselves as a weapon that you can point at a particular problem, but we're not inventing the problems.
Right. And that's awesome. And I love that.
I just want to underline that. That's a salient point.
That yeah, I heard the sharp and sharp breath there.
UX holds the weapon. Almost product management is the trigger.
Right, right.
Don't you guys are the ones wielding, like if we're a gun, you're pointing us where you want to point us.
The next time you have an interview with Glenn for UX, say that you are a gun and that you are a weapon. All right.
Exactly.
So, and thank you, Glenn, that, you know, and Cindy, you reconfirmed that's a salient point that needs to be underlined. Okay, so we're going to jump in and talk a little bit about startups, lean startups, organizations that may not have each of these particular roles broken down into, you know, one particular headcount. What's your view on how maybe startups where there is no UX or specific UX headcount or specialist there, how do they navigate to sort of aspire to at least deliver on an excellent user experience at the product level? If they may, when you just have a product manager or a CEO and a few engineers, how do they survive in this lean startup approach?
Right. Like in Marketo, in the beginning, there was no product manager. It was just me. And titles really don't matter in a small startup, right? You're making decisions, so you're the de facto product manager or you're the de facto designer. And very often an engineer is in that position. I've worked with a lot of different startups and helping them with this. I believe the presentation I gave where I met Cindy, it was a presentation to product managers of how to do the UX job without UX. And I was teaching them techniques, books to read. And one of the things I told people is somebody has to care. You know, you start there. Somebody needs to care that the experience is a good one, that the problem is a good one, and that it's, you know, the product's going to be great. Once you identify somebody who cares, then it's more a matter of empowering them to make the decisions and pointing them in the right direction on the web of books to read, blogs to frequent, and people to talk to so that you can at least educate yourself if you didn't have any education before. I've seen engineers do it, product managers do it, and designers do it. And it's okay in the sense of when you're in a startup, it's typically with very high caliber smart people, and you have that small group, so the communication overhead is very low, and that really helps. I've written probably the same thing multiple times around, here's the lessons for the new person. You got to read About Face by Alan Cooper. It's like a reference book, but it'll teach you user interface as quickly as anything else. You have to understand what the technology is made out of that you're designing with. So in other words, if this is a HTML JavaScript application, you need to understand enough about HTML, CSS, JavaScript so that you can have intelligent conversations with the engineers. If it's an iPad app, you need to understand what are the limitations, how hard is it to do things, and what is that made out of. Interestingly, I had a very difficult time with a certain design job where they were using Flex because I was less familiar with the Flex architecture than I was with HTML and JavaScript. And that I could notice a lot of my decisions were a lot more tentative because I wasn't sure how they would do it or how hard it would be. But when you're in that lean startup mode, it's, you know, I guess they call them T-shaped people, and you really need to be able to cover broad ground. And if the person is a product manager, I've actually collected a lot of tips on my personal blog because I get that question so often. But if you look at Quora or UX.StackExchange, the same questions are asked all the time. You know, I'm new to this. Where do I look at? What books do I read?
In your role as UX, when you were starting out at Marketo, did you also influence maybe the types of technologies that would be used to deliver the product, or was that separate or just in the realm of engineering or something that, you know, UX, you know, you as a UX pro weighed in on at all?
Absolutely, I influenced engineering a lot. In 2006, I became one of the earliest users of jQuery. When it first came out, I pushed it on all of Intuit's sites, and I started doing all kinds of stuff on TurboTax.com, Payroll.com, Intuit.com, QuickBooks.com, et cetera, using jQuery, because I loved it. It was awesome. I mean, you could do so much without being a programmer, of which I'm not a programmer. I used to qualify for saying I was a web developer, but not, you know, really a programmer. And then I met a lot of the JavaScript. It was a very hot time, 2006 and 2007, and I was speaking at places like Ajax Experience and meeting a lot of JavaScript guys, like the guys who founded Dojo, and I met this guy, Jack Slocum, who had founded a company called EXTJS, which was really an open source project, but it was these great client-side components in JavaScript. And he had an excellent interaction design sense and was a great programmer and actually helped him with some of the interaction design of some of his components. And I talked the Marketo group into using 0.33 alpha of that product, some of which is still in the app. And we're trying to, like, upgrade. They're at 4.0 at this point. And we've been trying to keep upgrading, you know, because the products have been getting better and better over the years. And they moved from a distributed open source organization to a commercial organization. They moved to Palo Alto. They got funding. And then now they're competitive products. But the entire front end is built out of, they're now called Sencha. And our entire front end is built out of that. In other cases, when we were talking about the landing page editor, and I said it should work like PowerPoint. You know, look at PowerPoint now. I just drag stuff around and it stays where I want it to stay. And that no, there was no landing page editor in the world that worked that way in 2007. But I described to the founders how absolute positioning works. And I was describing to them, you know, I mean, I was hand waving a lot, but I knew that they knew what I meant. And I walked them through how to do it with absolute positioning. And we ended up doing it that way. It was a major advantage for us, where people said, that's the kind of editing I want to do. Like, I'm used to it like PowerPoint, and I don't want it to be this in-flow thing, which didn't make as much sense to people. And so all of those kind of things is where, because I understood technology, even though I wasn't a programmer, I heavily influenced a lot of the key elements that went into the architecture.
And I must admit, as a Marketo customer myself, one of the things we were delighted with was that, you know, our marketing team, just that little landing page editor was so simple that anybody could use it. It allowed us to really have flexibility. When you say a user experience, it's the thing that delights you. You know, you're like, oh, wow, I didn't know you could do that. And for us, that was a telling part of the feature of the app. So great job. Cindy asks about creating flat product teams. I guess this is more now the management of UX. You know, how do you create these flat product teams where there are evident silos, you know, between certain functions?
I have a particular philosophy around management, and I don't know if it's applicable to everyone, but this is definitely the way I work. For a while, I was managing both UX and product management. I don't think that it's the manager's job to divvy up the different tasks for the different product managers or for the different designers. So, like, take design as an example. I tell the designers, here's the stuff that is higher, that is priority, you know, and I share an office with the head of product management now, and I'm sitting in the middle of the product managers, and my team is sitting in the middle of engineers. And so I tell them, okay, these are the high priority items, and it is up to them to figure out who's going to do what. I don't tell them who should do anything, they do. And that allows them to, you know, like when you assign somebody something, it's not the same as when they say, I want to do this, and, you know, like you're trading with your peers and you're claiming something. And I said the exact same thing to the product managers. I'm not going to tell you, like, whose area is what. You guys figure that out. Because when a small team self-organizes like that, it sticks way more than when a boss does it. Because you're never going to get it all right. You're never going to, you know, make every seam between people make sense. But when people do it independently, and, you know, they might have arguments and you might have to split a tie, but I found that I've never actually had to split a tie, that people figure it out on their own. When you trust people to act like adults and figure out who's going to do what, they always rise to the occasion. And so I find that that's the way to get a flat organization where you still have that ownership. And, you know, like, it's important to have good communication. And so, you don't want to use the word silo because, you know, that kind of implies that there isn't strong communication between people. But they definitely should have strong feelings of ownership and feelings that they care about it and really want it to be great. But that's how I instituted, is by letting the team, without my involvement, figure it out amongst themselves.
That was something you started even as a startup. It wasn't something that came on later. It was part of your DNA once you started at Marketo.
I'm trying to remember exactly when I started doing that. I mean, I had a lot of people at Cocoa Interactive in New York City, and it's basically, it's a matter of trust. Like, I hire great people. I trust the great people. If you, there's an old Kathy Sierra cartoon that is the zombie function, and it goes, the more you use your reins, the less they'll use their brains. And I want people to feel like they're being smart and setting their own agenda and setting their own ownership of something, not that they're being told what to do every time. And because it's a waste of my time, and I don't think it yields the right emotional commitment from people. And it doesn't work at every level, it doesn't work at every size. I think it works for when you've got a half a dozen people. If you have two people, you know, it's a little bit different. And this just happens to be, like, right now we have about 5 and 5 between product managers and UX designers, and it works at that level. And I've never tried it, you know, with what if there's 50 people and how does that work? The funny thing is, except for that 1 year at Intuit, I've never been in an organization that has grown like this. So a lot of this is new to me, and I'm making it up as I go along of what feels right, and, you know, at every step saying, are there mistakes to learn from and just keep pressing on?
That's awesome. When we started this conversation, you talked about hiring of UX and that you've gone through the process of hiring a lot of UX professionals. And I was curious whether or not you had any thoughts about how has the hiring process changed, you know, how you see UX professionals when they now come to you to work with you. Is there anything that sticks out that is changing in terms of either what they are getting or what they are losing? Is there an evolution in the process of building the teams that you're seeing from people who come looking to, you know, join your team in the UI UX role?
It's definitely evolving. One of the things that I'm finding is that you have to tease apart website designers from product designers, and that, you know, like the recruiters aren't. They're just giving you everybody. And I've actually, like, I've worked with fewer recruiters so that I can spend a lot of time with them, giving them feedback about the work that is coming from the designer so that they understand the difference between the two. Because it really is it's such a vast chasm between the two. Having website design experience does not prepare you to make a product. And then within that group of product designers, you have B2C products and B2B products. Now, B2C products are simpler, less scope, but highly polished. They're really designed to do not that many things, but just do it at scale and do it well. If you look at Twitter, even though it's grown over time, it doesn't do that many things. You know, it's become very good at doing a smaller group of things, where if you look at something like Marketo or SAP or Oracle, not all these products are noteworthy in terms of how great the user experience is, but designing those kind of products is much more complicated. They do a lot of things, and the products are built over years and have expanded tremendously. And so it's really important to, when you're talking to designers, make sure you understand where they're coming from and what they're looking to do. And for me, my number one criteria is smarts. When I'm talking to somebody and if I describe something and they add some intelligent add-on, like, oh, well, that makes me think of XYZ, and I say, oh, that's smart. That's probably my number one criteria, because everything that we're doing is complicated. There's lots of different ins and outs. There's lots of different integration partners. It's a big, big application that does a lot of stuff. And then even on that one landing page editor, there's a lot of little subtleties to it. And if you are smart, you're going to get it right away and you'll be able to contribute. If you struggle with what does this do, I think the system would become overwhelming. And that's not to say, like, we need for the customers the experience for them, it should be easy. Like, one of the things I say is simple things should be simple and complex things should be possible. And it takes a lot of effort to make that true, you know. And so in terms of hiring, I've been finding I go through a process of first talking to people on the phone or having lunch with them, and I'm just trying to find if they have, like, the cultural fit, if they have energy about them, if they think about design as a serious consideration, if they have read books or have influences from people. I want to know that they're thinking. And then if they pass that test, we bring them in for longer interviews with engineering, product management, and other UX people where we do design exercises, and we're just trying to figure out what would it be like working with this person, and do they have good creativity and problem-solving skills. But it's really it's a difficult position to hire for, and we go pretty slowly because I want to make sure that every person that we add is a superstar. Every person we add is going to be well-respected by the organization and do a great job. Because in a small group of, like, five people, you have one who doesn't work out and they taint the entire group. You end up with the feeling from, you know, one department somewhere that UX is not the team to go to get your problem solved. And I want to make sure that we're always thought of as the A team, and we're always thought of as a great place to go to help the project go better.
Excellent. I'm going to take that as your summarizing point, Glenn. This was great. The hour goes by. You got really deep. Tarek, excellent questions. Thank you so much. If you enjoyed hearing Glenn talk today, please join the AIPMM webinar on October 12th, where Glenn will have the advantage of a visual to go deeper into probably describing for product managers what UX is all about, that in-depth conversation of how it all works together at Marketo. Coming up this weekend is Silicon Valley Code Camp, October 6th and 7th, all day. It's a free event. I think registration might still be open. It's the 7th Code Camp. It's an unconference in 7 years produced by Peter Kellner. I will be there. There is a product management track this year. I will be in the session on high-performing product teams with my colleague Greg Girasi, who will be talking about a recent study about how product teams can work together and what are the ingredients for the most successful product teams. Coming up on October 10th, please join us in San Francisco at Atlassian for another startup product talk. Go to sfproducttalks.com to check out who the upcoming speaker will be. This Wednesday is an AIPMM webinar on how product management can make or break your company. Go to AIPMM.com, look on the webinars to register for that, and join me. I will be moderating that webinar with Brian Lawley of 280 Group. Thank you so much, Glenn, for joining us. Thank you, Tarek, for jumping in. You were great. Definitely, I will have you both back to talk some more. And it's interesting, you had said early on, Tarek, that I don't know if Glenn remembered meeting you when you were having drinks after a conference. And that's totally what the intention of this is, to have it be a conversation as if we just attended a conference and we were having drink. You guys were quite sober, so I appreciate that.
And thank you very much, Cindy. It was an awesome pleasure to be with Glenn on this event.
Yeah, it was really fun. Thank you for having me.
As I say every week, we just kind of scratched the surface. Follow us at blogtalkradio.com/prodmgmttalk, and you'll get reminded of upcoming events. Thank you to our sponsors at theaipmm.com and our new sponsor, Atlassian, which is transforming the world with software. Thank you also to Studio 132 for providing sound engineering. Have a great week.
Thank you to our broadcast sponsor, Atlassian. Software is transforming the world. Atlassian is helping transform the teams building it. Atlassian helps innovators everywhere plan, build, and launch great software. Find out why more than 21,000 companies of all sizes use Atlassian issue tracking, collaboration, and software development products to work faster and smarter together. Visit Atlassian.com, Atlassian.com. Thank you to our platinum sponsor, the Association of International Product Marketing and Management. Visit them on the web, www.aipmm.com. The AIPMM is a worldwide certifying body of product marketing, management, and team professionals. The AIPMM promotes worldwide excellence and forwards product management professionalism with certification credentials, education, trainings, networking, and professional growth opportunities. AIPMM membership benefits include eligibility for certification, partner offerings and training discounts, productivity tools, career center, mentor matching, advanced access to new curriculums, webinar series, thought leaders, and private events. AIPMM certification credentials allow individual members to demonstrate their level of expertise and provide corporate members an assurance that their product professionals are operating at peak performance. Subscribe to the AIPMM Product Management News and Views newsletter, www.aipmm.com/subscribe. Follow at AIPMM on Twitter.